Hey everybody, my name is Alex and this is Lunchbox Radio. Now, before we get started, I wanted to encourage you to go listen to the latest episode before this one, which is all about a revisitation of My Hero Academia. And actually, I've kept watching My Hero Academia because of all of my like weird thoughts on that show. And if you want to know more about that, definitely go listen to the previous episode in the feed. And with that said, I think we should jump into what we're talking about this week, which is a little show from last season called The Apothecary Diaries.
Anime considered. Lunchbox Radio.
Now, before we get started talking about what this show is, I wanted to have I give us a little plot summary since it's a little complicated, but, I, take it away.
The Apothecary Diaries follows the story of Mao Mao, a clever and observant young woman who originally worked as an apothecary in the city's pleasure district. Her life takes a dramatic turn when she is kidnapped and sold into the Imperial Palace as a low-ranking servant. Despite the drastic change in her circumstances, Mao Mao's knowledge of chemistry and poisons quickly makes her an indispensable part of the palace. While serving in the inner court, where the Emperor's many consorts and children reside, Mao Mao discovers that there are numerous mysterious incidents and subtle power struggles hidden beneath the surface of the seemingly tranquil palace life. When she stumbles upon a health issue affecting the Emperor's children, her sharp observational skills and medical knowledge bring her to the attention of Jinshi, a handsome and mysterious eunuch who holds significant power within the palace. Mao Mao is then covertly enlisted by Jinshi to help solve various medical mysteries and quietly thwart assassination attempts and political machinations. Despite her unassuming role as a servant, her involvement becomes crucial in protecting the royal family and navigating the dangerous waters of court intrigue.
Now that that's out of the way, we can talk about what I kind of love about this show. And it has to do a lot with what I love about a lot of Josei-style stories. So if you don't know anything about the like classic delineations of manga that then kind of elevate up to anime by way of necessity, shonen, which is the most popular kind of for a long time now style of story, means stories aimed at young or preteen or teenage boys. Shoujo is the same thing except for girls. And I believe it's seinen is aimed at older teens, at older men, and what's it called? Josei is aimed specifically at older teenage women and older teenage women and up. Now, a good example of what a Josei story looks like is actually a show that came out many, many years ago. This is a cult classic at this point, which I actually really love just because of kind of its unapologeticness on like what it is. And that's a show called Princess Jellyfish. If you've never seen Princess Jellyfish, I don't think I've talked about it here yet. Definitely go watch that show. It's out there. You can go find it. It's a fun, weird time. But it's kind of, usually they're more grounded stories. They're more, they explore like being a woman in the world in a way that, not that shoujo like Sailor Moon or anything of its ilk doesn't, but they're more concerned with like, no, this person has to deal with like real life shit. Like they don't get to just have a magical girl transformation and like fix things by punching somebody real hard with a tiara was a tiara you used as brass knuckles. Like, and that's a little bit of what shoujo kind of does. It's like the female equivalent of a power fantasy, and I know that sounds insane, but you look at stuff like even something like Utena has a certain female empowerment fantasy to it, but Jose is much more like, you're not gonna get out of this with superpowers. But the thing that both Seinen and Jose's stories allow for, they allow usually for a much more intricate plot treatment, because they are explicitly aimed not at a super general audience, but at an audience who probably has more media literacy, more understanding of history and stuff like that. So it allows for a greater exploration of characters and story than you're necessarily going to get in something like what I would talk about, My Hero Academia. And lately, kind of post the 2011 Hunter x Hunter adaptation, I would actually say, in my brain, shonen stories have been doing a lot more like introspection and, you know, self-critical thought than they were before that, because the Hunter x Hunter has always been pretty popular, but that 2011 adaptation of it, like, knocked it out of the park in a way that said, like, okay, we can do this. We can have this. We can have these real conversations beyond the kind of structure that we were working within before. And in its best moments, that stuff kind of bubbles to the surface. So to give you a perfect example, I'm still watching My Hero Academia, not as intensely as I was, but like, I'm still going through it, because the new season comes out in May. That thing has a real moment in right after the overhaul arc, right after when they rescue that girl Eri, where they're like, oh, the world did this girl dirty. Like, we need to do our best to, like, fix this. And, like, they all kind of, like, it's there's a moment there where everybody pauses and is like, how did this shit happen? Come think about it. How did any of the shit in this world happen? This seems like everybody's failing all the time. And if you continue to follow the storyline from that to the, to, like, all the stuff about the Todoroki family, the show's doing a lot of setup that I, like I said in that episode, and you should really go listen to it, it doesn't necessarily pay off because it can't be interested in that, but it does at least have this thought process of like, hey, isn't the world of My Hero Academia kind of cursed and fucked up? And Jose and it's like, the other half of that coin, Seinen, kind of function from an assumption that the world's fucked up. They are very much forcing their character. They're very much creating a fictional story in a factual world, if that makes any sense. Like, and if you look at this show, The Apothecary Diaries, you'll see that Mao Mao, the main character, is just kind of like dealing with the cards she's dealt constantly. There's very little, and she makes it really clear throughout the show, like, there's very little she can do about many things that just happened to her. She, and they, in the very beginning, like the first episode, the Mao Mao's adopted father, I forget his name, and you don't know that he's her adopted father at this point, but you find that out by the end of the show. He said something to her in the effect of like, "Hey, don't get caught by people who kidnap young women and sell them into indentured servitude in the palace." And she's like, "Yeah, that's why." And she's like, "Yeah, I won't." And she eventually, that does happen to her. That's like, she is not, Mao Mao is not like, she goes to work for the palace. She is, for all intents and purposes, abducted and taken to the palace. And they explain this later on in the, like, pretty quickly in the show, but later on in the first episode, that the reason why this keeps happening is if someone is sold into servitude in the palace, or in the rear palace in ancient China, in this depiction of ancient China, I'm not sure how super true this is, but it sounds pretty true. It sounds like a shitty thing that would happen. The people who acquired this person and essentially dropped them in the lap of the palace to be used gets a cut of their salary. And what that means is every time you make money, they make money. And there's a great scene where you see this realization dawn on the woman who basically writes the paycheck face when she's talking to Mao Mao, and she's like, "Oh, I see. You don't want your captures to get any of this money." And she just like looks at this vase, just whips it off the table and breaks it. She's like, "Ah, that was really expensive. I would say this is gonna take you a couple years to pay that off." So there's not gonna be any extra for your captors. Oh well. And in that moment, there's this great understanding, and this understanding is kind of the kind of sisterhood effect that's happening with the entire female cast of this show, in that they all know, in like the parlance of ancient China, they all come second. And so they do everything they can to help each other where they can, in most cases. And the ones who don't, very clearly, like, A, don't know what's going on, and B, you find out later on, are largely incompetent. And so what this show kind of sets up is, it sets up first, in a primary way, this kind of detective drama that's based initially around solving for illnesses and solving for ills that is necessary in the rear palace, that was not being served well in the rear palace. And So when she first gets there, she very quickly is kind of railroaded into becoming a taste tester, and becomes the taste tester for one of the primary concubines of the emperor. And one of the things I like about this show is they make it really clear that none of the cast of the show will be kind of off limits to her, to Mao Mao eventually. And like, eventually, when it needs to happen that she might need to talk to the emperor, she's just in the room with the emperor. where she's in the room. Like, the show figured out a way to put her where she needs to be without breaking all the rules around it to make that happen, if that makes any sense. And in the moments, so that makes the moments when it does break those rules, when Mau Mau is intentionally like, no, this is worth the risk, feel heavier, because the rules aren't being broken again and again and again and again and again without consequence. They're being broken and there's consequences. And the consequences change things just ever so slightly and like move things ever so slightly in a way that makes sense. So Mau Mau is like, she works as an apothecary, and an apothecary is essentially a herbalist or a pharmacist. They are the the original pharmacists, and they are the original version of pharmacists in ancient China. And what she does is she basically experiments on herself constantly. And as a result of that, I think it's her right wrist that's wrapped in bandages, because she's just like dipping needles and poisons and sticking herself with them on her right wrist all the time. So like her right wrist has this insane, like, blistering nightmare rash that's just like, I went full human experimentation, but like only on my wrist here. And there's a plot point that might tag her as being like part of like a plot to overthrow the emperor quietly or something, and it's pretty much dismissed. It's not dismissed with her, but it you kind of get that the reason why no one's looking into her is because, like, if she unwraps her wrist and they just see, like, festering boils, and they're like, what the fuck happened? And she tells them, like, everybody in the show would be like, no, yeah, she's telling the truth. That's, yeah, okay, please stop doing that. That seems bad for you, but she's telling the truth. And kind of the person who is her main, the main love interest / quest giver / like head of household for the rear palace is this character named Jinshi. And Jinshi, in kind of classic shoujo romance tradition, is drop dead gorgeous. Like, gorgeous in a way that outshines the prettiest woman in the room. He is just like slight and beautiful and just like radiant. And he's also like fairly high up. But he's also fairly high up the food chain, but he's also, and it would, he is essentially in charge of the entire rear palace. And he's like a hit with every single female attendant to all of the concubines. All the concubines are also really fond of him, but they are devoted to the emperor. But they still, like, they're like, oh, hey, Jinshi. But all of the concubines' attendants are, like, fawning all over him endlessly. But the thing now is, like, they do a really good job of writing Mau Mau as just, like, a rotten little weirdo. Which makes her great to watch. But also, she has the exact opposite reaction to Jinshi. And she's like, no, this guy is gross. Like, Actually, I shouldn't say that she thinks he's gross. She thinks that he's... She's like, oh, yeah, he's ultra attractive. What a pain in the ass he seems like. Like, her value system is not in hot, rich, well-stationed guy. Her value system is, I would rather not deal with all of that. And the thing that the show... The big thing that sets Mau Mau apart from not the general workers in the Rear Palace, but all of the attendants and things, all the people who've climbed up a little bit, is that she's from the bad neighborhood. She's from the and she is from she's from essentially the slums. And she grew up in and around this brothel called the Verdigris House. And the Verdigris House has has courtesans who are like sought after, and the Verdigris House is run by this hilariously awesome, very business obsessed old woman. I forget her name, but Mau Mau, you come to find out that Mau Mau knows who her parents are, but it seems like it could be an open secret, but it probably isn't. It's probably a secret but more than a couple people know about it. And even though she has clearly an adopted father figure, it's very clear to everybody, like, this girl's just out here doing whatever the fuck she wants. And, like, the world doesn't mess with her. And the more time the show spends with her, you realize that the world doesn't mess with her because the world isn't ready for the consequences, largely, of messing with her. And everybody kind of understands what those consequences would be. And part of that is she's kind of the attending doctor for the Verdigris House. All of the courtesans at the Verdigris House absolutely adore her. That is like her family in a real way. And the whole story feels really balanced and really intelligent. And it feels like a version of pharmaceuticals and medicine and, like, all basically anything that can be compounded in the way that pharmaceuticals are compounded, almost, or to some extent anything that, like, needs solving, anything that's like a puzzle box, before people really could immediately get all the answers or had many of the answers. And the things that she fixes at first are just things like one of the main courtesans, I forget her name, she had a baby who fell ill and died. And the point of the courtesans is to, like, get pregnant and bear a male heir. And this courtesan had a male heir, that male heir died. But the thing about living as a courtesan is, like, it's a lot of it is performance. You are performing for the emperor and the world around you. And they make a really good point of being like, Mau Mau's not a Lady Liwa is the courtesan that she first helps. Mau Mau is not unaware of, like, sex and attraction and all of this stuff. She just chooses not to bother with it. But she does understand it, and she understands it in a way that very few people do, because she grew up kind of in and around the Verdigris house, which means she's like, she knows just how to be sexy. She just truly does not value it day to day, because she had no reason to really value it day to day. And case in point, eventually you find out, like, a thing she does out of habit to defend, to try and deter people from kidnapping her, which ends up happening anyway, is instead of applying, like, beautiful makeup, she applies makeup to make herself seem more plain and ugly. Specifically, she applies freckles to her face every morning to make herself less appealing to anybody who might want to snatch her. And that shows a real depth of understanding of, like, oh no, I know how to do good makeup. I just don't, because it's not safe. And so much of the show speaks to what it is to be a woman in ancient China and in this whole system of hierarchy that is not like, and the really important part is that it says it really clearly and out loud in a way that, like, yes, if you understand history, you would get much of this. But I think it's important to have shows that just straight up are like, no, like, you don't, you, like, unless your business is being hot and sleeping with people, like, you probably don't want to do that in a place that doesn't have many rules about how the genders are treated. But also, there can exist common sense. So one of the four courtesans in the rear palace is this character named Lady Li Xu. And Lady Li Xu is just a preteen. She is fucking probably 13 years old. And the emperor, like, plays nice, and he does visit Lady Li Xu the same as he visits the other three courtesans, but he doesn't, like, it's pretty clear that, like, he doesn't touch her and probably won't ever touch her. Like, it's like the thing that's pretty clear about some of the courtesans, including one who comes in like the second part of the season, is that they don't really have a full autonomy. They are kind of political pawns. They are sent by outside people to be partners, to be potential partners and bear children for the emperor, but strings come attached to that. So there are courtesans who chose to be there and courtesans who just kind of ended up. And they have a character who I named Ayun. She is revealed to be a childhood friend of the emperor. And she was made a courtesan because, like, they didn't know what to do with her. They didn't kind of know what to do with her. And the emperor was like, I don't want to kick her out of my life. She's my friend. I'm very fond of her, but not like that. And just the, like, trappings of the world, the, like, the society, the societal rules, which also, and this is something that isn't forgotten, but can be missed from time to time,
and lots of things talking about the old world, the old ways, is that, like, the emperor is not even really free in, like, ancient China, in ancient or current Japan, even in something like England or any of the countries that have monarchs. They are weighed down by the system, too. They aren't weighed down by the system as much as the people under them, but there's stuff almost reaching up and pulling them down, too. So, like, it would look odd for the emperor, who has no male heir and no empress, to have a female friend. To be palling around with a lady. It would just, in the same way that there are people in the world who believe that men and women can't be friends, which I can tell you, as somebody whose best friend is a woman who I just met her boyfriend. Hi, Kie. Tell your boyfriend hi. That's just not true. But, like, the system, it almost doesn't matter what the two people in the system think. If the system doesn't approve of it, then it kind of can't exist. And so, in order to keep his station and also to protect his friend, he makes Otto a courtesan for like a period of time. And eventually, Otto gets, I forget what happens to her, but, like, they play her off stage, essentially, in a really dignified and meaningful way, where, like, she gets to be not, she gets to kind of not deal with it anymore, but also, she has to not deal with it in a new situationship because of what they did to begin with. And Lady Lishu is kind of like that. She is clearly, she's essentially a child bride that the groom did not want, but was forced on him. And then you have characters like Lady Liwa, or the main courtesan, who's the head of the I think it's the I forget what the pavilion's name is, but she's got pink hair, but she and Lady Liwa are essentially, like, when the story opens, are the two courtesans who are, like, actively care for the emperor and love him and trying to have his kid, except for Lady Liwa. But the other thing is that so much of relationships in modern times is a function of there being a baseline equality between everybody and that being understood by everybody, and then the entire world looking in on those two people. And it's also, it's a normative thing. So when you are in a relationship with another person, male or female, it's seen as normal to only be in a relationship with one other person. But the definition of normal has been allowed to be kind of anything that you're okay with. But what if the definition of the baseline of normal that society accepted was everybody has three girlfriends. Everybody has three significant others. That would look like a very different world. That would be a very different thing. In this time period, it was normal for the emperor not to necessarily have just one partner, but to have multiple partners. And so the partners, yes, there's a competition there, But they can be less catty about it if they choose. So, like, Lady Liwa at... So, like, at all the Corazins kind of understand, like, Lady Lishu has to be here, but that doesn't mean she wants to. So, we're just going to kind of think of her as, like, our younger sister, and it will be fine. And there's a competition there, but there's also a kind of understanding that, like, they all have to live under the same roof, and there's also just, like, we live in a society and there are rules kind of thing. And Lady Gyokyo, who's a main side character in the first part, has successfully born a child, but it's a baby girl. And so I think it's a baby girl. So she's the one who Mau Mau ends up going to work for as a food taster. And she tastes food to make sure it's not poisoned before Lady Gyokyo eats it. But in addition to that, she helps solve the makeup issue with Lady Liwa. And then she solves it again. And you start to understand, because first she solved it because Lady Liwa's baby was growing ill again. And the baby was going to die, period. But, like, there was clearly some sort of insidious thing that was happening. And basically and this was a thing that was a known problem with makeup before... With makeup before a certain time period. I want to say before the 1920s. Makeup used to contain heavy metals. And those metals would poison whoever used them, slowly causing them to basically slowly waste away. And this was even more common in East Asia with the biggest use of makeup was face whitening, paints and powders. And these would not only be harmful to the person wearing them, but be also harmful to anybody they came in close contact with, especially a child. And so initially Mau Mau was like, okay, we gotta get rid of all of this makeup. It, like, fucked up girls in the Verdigris house. That's why it's fucking you up and your son up. It's gotta go. And Lady Liwa is very clearly like, okay, cool, whatever. But then one of the attendants for Lady Liwa is like, Lady Liwa is falling behind in the Emperor's favor. Good thing I kept this secret tin of this makeup we talked. I still don't understand why we did it. And in that moment, Mau Mau turns like fucking feral on these attendants. On these ladies in waiting. She just turns feral on them. She's full on like, are you a fucking moron? Are you trying to kill your... Are you trying to kill her? Because that's what's gonna happen. You absolute dog shit stupid bitch. Like, if you haven't seen the show, it sounds like I'm exaggerating. But, like, she fucking rips into these girls. To the point where, for the rest of the show, they are genuinely afraid of her. And everybody watching, when people see her do this, they're like, oh, she's doing this because that's the only way she can make the point stick. And she knows that because she fixed this once and it's not fixed. So some dumbass has got to learn some hard truths. And along with that, she also gives Lady Liwa, like, a way to, like, get back in favor. And she's like, hey, so,
Lady Gilkill isn't built for this, but let me tell you about what boob jobs are.
And it's just like, the thing that becomes clear about Mau Mau that is different from other people in the world, and it's probably best demonstrated by the character she referred to as the Quack Doctor, a character named Gwyn, is that she has a genuine curiosity and interest to learn about everything. And the place where that's best suited to, like, hold her interest is, at this point, being an apothecary, being somebody who compounds drugs and all this other stuff. But in general, she just, like, she'll just take knowledge and store it for later. And if somebody gives her a weird problem to solve, like, later on in the series, they have this conversation about, like, we would love blue roses to once again bloom in the flower garden part for the flower garden party. And, like, so she is given this question of how to do this, and she pauses, and then she immediately puts together all the pieces of how to make a blue rose. And it's somebody who knows anything about flower cultivation. What she does would probably fucking work. It would just probably work. But she, so she has this kind of, love of knowledge and willingness to test that knowledge out and willingness to hold on to it because all knowledge is valuable to her. So of course she knows weird sexual position. She hung out with a bunch of courtesans in the pleasure district in ancient China. Absolutely she knows what a tit job is. Absolutely she knows, like, all of these various rules. And eventually you come to, by the way, if you haven't been able to tell, spoiler alert, I've been trying to stay away from very specific points, but here's where I'm gonna dive into them. So if you want to watch the show, the entire first season is available. You can definitely go watch it. And it's dubbed in English too, which is great. But you come to find out that she is actually the daughter of, I forget the character's name, but the daughter of a character named Lakan, who has face blindness. And if you don't know what face blindness is, basically face blindness is this condition where you can't recognize people's faces. Like, you have all of the iconographic ability to recognize everything else, but you can't recognize people's faces. And that's a real thing in the world. Like, there are both people who cannot recognize people's faces, and then there are people who commit people's faces instantly to memory so hard that they, like, have a unnerving familiarity with people because they saw them on the street once 3 years ago. Like, both sides of that coin exist. But Lakan in particular, you find out, has face blindness. And he struggles with it as a young child. Until eventually he is told by a Go instructor, who he looks up to, like, imagine people as playing pieces. And then maybe you'll be able to, like, at least get on in the world. And through imagining people playing pieces and thinking about them as pieces on a board, he becomes a master tactician, blah, 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 Bob's your uncle, whatever. But one of the few people who stood out to him was a courtesan who ended up being Mao Mao's mother. And this, that's kind of the end of the story, like Lock-On finally finding Mao Mao's mother and like having a seemingly uncharacteristic moment of like just like fucking the only woman who I've ever loved is here now. God damn. I will pay any amount to get the contract of this Corazon, who is, to be clear, definitely diseased. Like, not, he's not here for a good time or a long time. He's here because, like, this is the person he loves. And he also, the show makes it very clear, like, his daughter doesn't necessarily hate him or care for him. She mostly finds him largely annoying. But he genuinely does love his daughter. And the way you see that is he sees her face. When he's looking at Jinshi and Jinshi's attendant, they're just go pieces. Their heads are just go pieces. But he sees her face clearly. And you get this, like, fucked up idea that Lock-On has this attraction to intelligence that is such that, like, lets him see past his own inability to see faces and be like, no, this one's important. I need to remember this face specifically. And all of these pieces of this story make it really unique and really interesting in a way that I think is helped by the fact that it was... So for every show I talk about now, I use the GPT that I developed called Fujoshi Sensei, which is usually in the link of the description, in the description link section of every podcast. You can go check it out for yourself if you are subscribed to the GPT thing. But it's a GPT that I use to research production notes for production details for the show. What I found really interesting about this one is that it was a light novel and then a manga. And what that means is that it's had two passes at its story. And that means that the story has been really drilled down on. So in its third pass, the drilling down of that story allows it to really shine. In a way that, like, so, and I talked about this show previously. If you were looking for a lesser version of this show, you could watch something like Pharmacist in Another World, I think it's called. And it, like, that show just, it tries to be as interesting as this, but can't quite stick the landing. And it doesn't have anything to do with, like, the romantic subplots of a show between, like, having to do with Lock-On or between Mao Mao and Jinshi. It has to do with the treatment of intelligence and the appreciation of intelligence for what it is, and not just as this very specific, pointed, narrow thing. Because if you look at Therapist in another world, Pharmacist in Another World, that guy died at like a once in a generation pharmaceutical expert, and continues to apply that ability in a very narrow way in his next life. The kind of apothecary thing is what they use largely to get you into the kind of problem-solving matrix in Mao Mao's head, but they very quickly expand that to the point where, like, eventually they shift from the pharmaceutical questions being real problems and more to them, like, her showing application. Like, for example, they have to, they, at some point, the plot demands that Jinchi look like a common person. And so she does all these things to make him look less gorgeous by any measure. And she successfully does it, but, like, the way she does it, it's not hard for her to do it. It just takes time and effort, if that makes any sense. And on that note, that's where I'm going to leave it here, since we're at about an hour. But this has been Lunchbox Radio. I have been Alex. If you like the podcast, new episodes come out every Thursday, and they are an awful lot like this. And if you really like the podcast, I would appreciate it if you rate it 5 stars on your podcast app of choice and subscribe so you get new episodes every week. But until then, I'll talk to you next Thursday.